Land, sung by our prairie choir, directed by Barb Park, and accompanied by Carl Wacker.
And you're welcome to join in if the spirit moves you. Looks like we have the whole audience up here.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We are going to be connected via Zoom or here in person. We are one community today, united in love and purpose. My name is Rev. Ralph. I've been a member of Prairie for over 20 years, and I serve as Prairie's minister. This is my last month serving, and I will step away, and Mary Sue Rudebeck will then be serving as Prairie's minister. We welcome everyone here this morning. We know you come here for different reasons, to find community, to seek your spiritual and personal truths, to question, to nurture your heart and soul, to be nurtured, to explore new ideas, to find comfort, and perhaps to find the answers to some of your bigger questions. We welcome you. We know you come from different places, different religions, different beliefs, different backgrounds. We hope you will find comfort, connection, challenge, and love here. We hope you will find ways to provide outreach to others in our congregation, in our local community, and in our worldwide community. Our chalice lighting will be read by Ken Skog.
We light our chalice this morning in the spirit of gratitude. Thank you for Rev. Ralph's time of ministry. Thankful for Rev. Ralph's time of ministry and service to Prairie, for celebrations of life and death, for leading services, grounding our congregation in shared ministry, helping us to navigate the wonders and stresses of this world, and helping us to make sense of good times and bad. Thank you for being our leader, a comforter, and a friend. Thank you for being our minister.
Thank you, Ken. Our opening music is Strum, 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 Your Uke, and Funga Alifia, performed by Kira. We have a story this morning that tells something about the person that we will be celebrating tomorrow, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And this story is called When Martin Luther King Jr. Wore Roller Skates. Anyone here have roller skates? Do you have roller skates? Yeah. When Martin Luther King was a young boy, that was one of the most popular ways that children could play. They would have roller skates. That's because you could go and roller skate on streets. And when I was a young boy, that's what we used to do. We used to roller skate on the streets. But because there are too many cars today, it's not safe to roller skate on streets. This story begins when Martin Luther King was born on January 15th, 1929. In the hallway outside his bedroom, Martin Luther King Sr., Daddy King, was jumping up and down because his wife had just given birth to a baby boy. There he is, jumping up and down and celebrating. No one at that time knew that this small little boy would become a great man. The parents named their new baby boy Michael. But his father, a few years later, his father, Daddy King, was a minister, and he traveled to Germany and learned about a very famous religious leader, Martin Luther. And he was so impressed by the life of Martin Luther that when he came back home to Atlanta, he said that I'm going to change my name to Martin, and we're going to call our son not Michael anymore, but Martin. Martin's parents gave him a very wonderful life. He had a brother and sister. They used to play together. They used to have all sorts of people come and visit them because Daddy King was a very popular minister in Atlanta. Martin's mother taught him to believe in himself. She said, "You're as good as anyone. You're as good as anyone." In Martin's family, church was an important part of life. Once his father hosted a guest preacher from Virginia. The man talked to the folks about joining the church. Martin's sister was the first one to sign up. And when Martin saw her joining, little Did she know that he was also going to join? You're only 5 years old, said the preacher. And little Martin, only 5 years old, he said, I'm not going to let my sister get ahead of me. I'm joining next. There he is telling the minister, I'm going to join the church. Martin's family lived in a large home on Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. He played with his friends and he roller skated and biked up and down Auburn Avenue with his friends. And here he is riding on his roller skates. Does that look like fun?
Yeah.
Yeah. At school, Martin got along with the other children, but there was a bully in the school. And when that bully hit him, Martin refused to fight back. He knew violence was not the answer. Martin's brother was named Alfred Daniel, but everyone called him A.D. He and Martin loved to run and play. They played football and basketball. They played outside the fire station that was near their house. But because racial segregation, no black men or women worked there. But at the station, kids of different races all played together. See, all the kids are playing outside next to the fire station. Every evening, when the king sat down to eat dinner together, Martin's father, Daddy King, insisted that no one could eat until he came home. When Daddy King got home late, the kids were starving, but still they couldn't eat. First, they had to recite a verse from the Bible. The boys were smart. The verse they often picked was just two words. Jesus wept. It's the shortest verse in the Bible, said Martin with a grin. Martin often played with a boy from the neighborhood. It didn't matter that the boy that he played with was white. The two of them were good friends. But one day, the boy's father told his son that he could no longer play with Martin. Martin did not understand why the boys couldn't be friends. Why? He asked Daddy King. Why did his father say we can't play together? Martin's parents talked to him about race and segregation. They told him that black people were often treated terribly. Martin was shocked. He decided he should hate white people. You should not hate the white man. It's your duty as children to love him, said his parents. Martin had a hard time understanding this. How can I love a race of people who hate me and who are responsible for breaking me up and one of my best childhood friends? You must try, said his mother. One day I'll change these things, said Martin. One day I'm going to turn this world upside down. There he is. Can you imagine him saying, I'm going to turn this world upside down? What ever could he have meant? I'm going to turn the page here. Martin was determined. He felt angry when he experienced discrimination because of the color of his skin. And when he was only 14 years old, Martin traveled on a bus with his teacher to a speech contest far away from home. On the way back, Martin and his teacher were forced out of their seats so the white people on the bus could have a seat. It was a 90-mile home, a trip back home, and Martin, his teacher, stood for 3 hours on the ride home. You think that was nice? No. And here's what Martin said. It was the angriest I have ever been in my life. Martin was a very smart young boy. He skipped right over the 9th grade and the 11th grade, and he started college when he was only 15 years old. He was very popular in college. He had always thought he would become a minister like his father, but he began to question his faith. Eventually, though, he came back to his roots. "I have decided to leave the church," he said to his father. By the time Martin was 25 years old, he had earned a doctoral degree. He married Coretta Scott. Like Martin, she believed in the importance of peace. The couple settled in Montgomery, Alabama, and they had 4 children. Martin's parents were proud when he became a pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. His father, Daddy King, was especially happy. And here is Martin leading a service in the church that he served in Montgomery, the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. He was only 25 years old when he started that position. As Martin grew older, he became more active. Martin gave some of the most memorable speeches in American history. In 1963, he gave his famous "I Have Dreams" speech before over 200,000 people in Washington, D.C. In his speech, Martin said, "I have a dream that my 4 little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." There he is giving the speech. And tomorrow, all over America, there will be celebrations of the birthday of this very famous man, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Is what? In January. Yeah, January 15th. But tomorrow is the day on the 20th that we'll be the nation celebrates Martin Luther King Day. Thank you all for joining with me in reading this story about Dr. Martin Luther King. And now, children will be going back to their classes downstairs, and we'll be singing them out as they go. Let us now join our hearts and enter into quiet space. Join our hearts in the spirit of meditation. I will ring the chime as we begin, and I will ring the chime again at the end of our silent period. This year marks the 96th anniversary of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's birth. It's the 57th year after his assassination on April 4th, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee. As was the case in 1968, our country and around the world, we are facing various existential realities and challenges that are not in any way different from that period of 1968. We've been facing the COVID-19 health crisis, the economic stresses that many people face today, putting food on their table, were also present then, the painful effects of racial division and the forces of international discord were also evident in that time. Some of the events I will be describing are still vivid in my memory. I was a graduate student in Chicago in 1963 during the March on Washington when Dr. King gave his speech, I Have a Dream speech. In 1967, Carlene and I were living in Evanston, and I was traveling on a regular basis to Hyde Park while I was completing my master's degree at the University of Chicago. It was when Dr. King was organizing demonstration marches for open housing laws in Chicago. He was there with his family living in a slum apartment building in Lawndale neighborhood. The day Martin Luther King died, April 4th, his public disapproval rating was nearly 75%. That was a figure shocking even in that day. By comparison, disapproval ratings of Donald Trump today are now closely split between favorable 46%, unfavorable 48%. His best numbers since just after his 2016 presidential election, when 47% of Americans viewed him favorably and 50% viewed him unfavorably. Now, Martin Luther King Jr.'s approval rating has changed over time, from the low in the 1960s to highs in the 2010s. 1963, 41% of Americans viewed King favorably. In 1968, when King was assassinated, the public disapproval rating, as I mentioned, was only 75%. In 1999, 89% of Americans indicated they admired Dr. King. And in 2011, 94% of Americans had a favorable view of King, including 89% of those age 65 and over. And these are taken from the Gallup polls that were taken then. But let's begin. What do we mean when we say he was a prophet? Here's what one of his colleagues who shared the ministry calling as a Baptist minister has said, Reverend Gary Martin. Yes, Dr. King was a prophet in the truest sense of the word. A prophet in Old Testament times was God's mouthpiece. He did not speak for himself, rather he told the audience what the Lord said. Dr. King constantly reminded us of the words of Scripture. And here's what Reverend Nancy Conley said. She's the senior pastor at Peace United Methodist Church in Louisville, Kentucky. As I understand the meaning of prophet in a religious sense, it is one who shares a word from God. I believe that is part of the call of all clergy. Martin Luther King Jr. was first and foremost a clergy person who taught and preached from Scripture and believed in Jesus' command that we are to love one another. Well, King was a prophet in his time, but he also practiced this sense of loving and caring for one another. And I found this piece that describes an example of how Dr. King practiced that quality. It was written by the son of Reverend Ernest Gordon, Dean of the Chapel at Princeton University, and who had made contact with Dr. King since the middle 1950s. It goes like this. I remember the winter of 1960, near the end of January, when King took the train up from Washington, D.C. We picked him up in our old Peugeot station wagon at the Trenton Railroad Station. He traveled alone and seemed, to my youthful imagination, surprisingly small and unassuming when he stepped onto the platform wearing a woolen coat and a Homburg hat. Well, Martin Luther King was only 5 feet 7.5 inches tall, so he did seem small. I had heard my father speak of this man and his leadership of the civil rights movement. For me, he is one of the rare prophetic voices in the land, said my father, but I didn't really know what that meant. We took him to our house at 17 Ivy Lane. I remember the roads were icy. My father drove very slowly because we had been in an ice-related accident a few days earlier, and the back door of the Peugeot was smashed in. My father had tied a piece of twine to keep it shut, but it flew open after we rounded a traffic circle near the train station. Dr. King reached out and grabbed me so I wouldn't fall out the car. My mother was standing on the front porch, shivering in the cold, smoking one of her filtered cigarettes. Yeah, in those days, many adults smoked. She greeted Dr. King, led him up to the guest room at the top of the stairs, and made sure he was comfortable and had everything he needed. King was incredibly charming, and he took time to chat about things with my sister and I. He asked us about school, what books we were reading, and what sports we'd like to play. He then took a nap and came down a few hours later to meet the professors, students, and the civil rights workers and campus leaders of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who had assembled for the evening in our living room. Sadie Ray, the household cook, was preparing dinner for everyone, but she complained to my mother. Her minister at the First Baptist Church on Green Street had preached in a sermon that week and inferred that King was a troublemaker, a self-loathing Negro, in the preacher's words. At first, Sadie snubbed Dr. King and refused to serve him dinner. My mother was mortified. She didn't know what to do. She just stood there by the swinging pantry door, aghast. And Dr. King soon took things in his own hand. He walked into the kitchen, introduced himself, and sat at the round table near the stove, eating Sadie's food while explaining the civil rights movement and the great challenge of the NAACP as almost a one-on-one seminar. While the rest of the guests sat in the chill of the formal dining room, wondering what was going on back there in the kitchen. I remember that Dr. King was the sweetest, most humble guest, a friend, a luminous presence, a beautiful voice, right there in the room with you, making direct eye contact with you while speaking, shaping rhythms with his lips and with the words that he used, insisting on helping with the dishes after dinner, the center of attention but deferring to others, possessing an inner warmth, a sense of love for the everyday as well as the eternal, a soaring figure for any age, but none of us could have understood that yet. And then, needless to say, Sadie the cook was forever won over. In December 1954, King traveled to Norway to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And he donated the full amount of the award, the financial award, to the civil rights efforts he was organizing. And right after he returned from Oslo, he sat for a Playboy magazine interview with Alex Haley. In appearing in a Playboy magazine didn't make him appear unpopular among the religious conservatives, then the substance of what he said was even more of a scandal. He endorsed a massive federal aid program for blacks. Its whopping $50 billion price tag was, as he pointed out, less than annual U.S. spending on defense. Such an expenditure, he argued, would be more than justified in a spectacular decline in school dropouts, family breakups, crime rates, illegitimacy, swollen relief rolls, rioting, and other social evils. Many poor whites were in the very same boat with the Negro, he said. And if they could be persuaded to join forces with blacks, they could form a grand alliance and, quote, exert massive pressure on the government to get jobs for all, end quote. In March 1965, he led the marches for voting rights in Selma, Alabama. During that time, Unitarians Reverend James Reeb and Viola Liuzzo were murdered while supporting those efforts. And in June 1966, he completed fellow civil rights leader James Meredith's march against fear after Meredith was wounded by a white gunman in Oxford, Mississippi. And then in the summer of 1966, I had mentioned, he took his wife and four young children north to Chicago. They lived in a rented tenement apartment in the Lawndale neighborhood to experience firsthand the struggles and racial prejudices blacks were dealing with in the inner city slums. He organized a march through the all-white neighborhood of Gage Park as part of the Chicago Freedom Movement. During the march, he was hit in the head with a rock thrown by someone from the angry mob of jeering whites. He described them as more hateful than any he had seen even in Mississippi or Alabama. King did nothing to quell these concerns when he told the journalist David Halberstam that he had abandoned the incremental approach to social change in favor of pursuing a reconstruction of entire society, a revolution of values, one which would look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. King's vision of a revolution in values was not purely domestic. In 1967, he denounced America's involvement in Vietnam. And at the Ebenezer Baptist Church, which he had begun to serve in Atlanta, and at the Riverside Church in New York City, before an audience of 3,000 people, precisely a year before he was killed, he decried the hypocrisy of sending young black men 8,000 miles to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Chicago or East Harlem. Beyond that lay the painful irony of seeing them join white soldiers with whom they could hardly live on the same block in New York City or Atlanta, Georgia. In this, they were, however, unwittingly agents of what Dr. King said was the U.S. policy that destroyed and depopulated the countryside of Vietnam, forcing the former inhabitants to take refuge in cities teeming with hundreds of thousands of homeless children who were running in packs on the streets like animals. Now, one of his critics, Stokely Carmichael, who was the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC as it was called, observed that in this case, King was taking on not only a hopeless, unsympathetic villain like Birmingham Sheriff Bull Connor, but rather, quote, the entire policy of the United States government. The consequences were swift and severe. An outraged President Lyndon Johnson cut off contact with King, and a great number of black Americans, including many old allies and colleagues from the civil rights years, warned that his stance could have devastating consequence for their cause. In a context like this, his unpopularity had really dropped. His own stern insistence on a strict adherence to the doctrine of nonviolence met with growing disdain among a younger generation of black leaders. Tired of relying on excruciatingly slow process of peaceful protest and tedious negotiation, some mocked King's ministerial oratory and called him the Lord. It was hurtful for King to hear that. It was impatience with King's doctrine of nonviolence that turned what would prove to be his last march. He traveled to Memphis in support of the striking sanitation workers, and on March 28, 1968, a peaceful demonstration turned into a riot. Some marchers quickly broke ranks to break storm windows, and looting was soon underway. An aggressive police response took place, complete with tear gas and billy clubs, led some protester to retaliate with Molotov cocktails. By the end of this confrontation, one person was dead, some 50 others were wounded. Feeling repudiated and ashamed by this failure to prevent violence, King had to be pressured into returning to Memphis a week later to yet another march. One that a single assassin's bullet on April 4th made it certain that he would never march again in peaceful, nonviolent method. After King was assassinated, a Gallup poll wasn't taken to rate King until after August 2011. That's when the Martin Luther King Memorial was officially dedicated in Washington, D.C. By then, views of King had changed dramatically, as 94% of Americans had a favorable opinion of him. Americans were also broadly supportive of the memorial. 91% approved of it, and 70% were at least somewhat interested in visiting it, according to the Gallup survey. Now, I'd like to close my reflection on Dr. Martin Luther King this morning. Dr. Martin Luther King as an unwelcome prophet during his lifetime, with this letter that I found written by Anthony Hunt. He says, what would King say if he were living today to us? He might be saying some of this in the year 2025. And I read this. My dear American sisters and brothers, I greet you in the all-abounding love of God. I pray that all of you now find yourselves reasonably well and are continuing to strive toward living in peace with justice and striving to become the beloved community. In reflecting on the nearly 55 years since my last public address at Mason Temple Church of God in Christ in Memphis, Tennessee, on the night of April 3, 1968, my assassination on a balcony at the Lorraine Motel at 6:01 p.m. the following evening in that same city, much has occurred in America. Much of the progress that was eventuated up to my death, as seen in the passing of the National Civil Rights Legislation in 1964 and the Voting Rights Legislation in 1965, seemed to come to full fruition when the election of Barack H. Obama in 2008 as the 44th President of the United States, the first African American to hold the nation's highest office. And yet, in the past several years, there has been a heightened emergence or reemergence of evils such as racism, classism, sexism, xenophobia, homophobia, misogyny, white supremacy, and forms of Christian nationalism that now serve to perpetuate and exasperate division in much of American society and even in large segments of churches. I remind you that less than 2 miles from the U.S. Capitol is located a memorial in my name, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. Etched in circular stone walls surrounding the memorial are several of my most notable quotes. A few of them I remind you of today. True peace is not merely the absence of tension, it is the presence of justice. And we shall overcome because the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Another sentiment that is etched into my memorial's wall is, darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. In light of the challenges that confront you, I remind you to remain cognizant that each of you is called to be the light and love that the nation and the world need to overcome darkness and hatred now extant among you. Remember that there is a certain collective voice among those of you who are committed to seeing that the vision of the prophet Amos is realized. Justice would roll down as waters and righteousness as a mighty stream from the prophet Amos, book 5, verse 24. There is a great deal more that I could share, but I will conclude my letter by encouraging you to never give up dreaming and hoping for a better tomorrow. Regarding hope, I remind you of my past sentiments that hope is always animated and undergirded by faith and love, and that hope is the refusal to give up despite insurmountable odds. Always remember, you have hope. You have hope. And you have faith in everything, if you have hope. Never forget my words on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in August 1963, in the dream that I shared with the nation on that sunlit day, that there would someday be, hewn out of the mountain of despair, a stone of hope. Now my dream of for you, America, remains the same as it was almost 60 years ago, that the beloved community will become a reality. As always, I pray that yours will be a future filled with hope. With agapeic love, Martin. So may it be. Amen. We now take time for discussion around the focus of by reflection, relying upon our covenant of good relations as a guide to ensure all voices are welcome and relationships are valued. If you want to add something to the discussion, please come forward and come to the microphone. If you can't come forward, we will have microphones. Someone will bring one to you. Introduce yourself with your name and pronouns as welcome. For those on Zoom, please raise a virtual hand, unmute once called on, or you may type into the chat and have your comment read aloud. Any Kent? Kent, do you have a microphone?
Kent Winger, he, him. Just a couple of things. I just was really curious. Reverend Ralph mentioned that in 2011, 94% of Americans had a positive view of Martin Luther King Jr. Interestingly and discouragingly, I just was looking online. By 2023, that number had declined from 94% to 81%. And then another thing, sort of on the Vietnam connection, and this is something I just found out very recently that was very interesting. There was a very prominent American general in World War II named James Gavin, and he was one of the leaders of desegregating the army in the post-World War II period. He and one or two other very prominent American generals actually opposed U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War on the grounds that we had no vital national interest in that conflict and that we should only fight when we had a vital interest. So I found that very interesting to find out.
Yeah. Well, there were many in America who were also opposed to the war in Vietnam, so that was a very controversial time, if you were living then. Gary.
Gary, he, him. Much as I admired Dr. Luther King and his approach to life, I have never agreed with it. Because I cannot be that optimistic about the human race. History is showing us that violence and disrespect of others is a part of our nature. I still, however, feel that his message is valid, that we must strive and maintain for ourselves that we want to make the world better, even though I don't believe that we'll ever succeed in abolishing racism or sexism or whatever. We must always strive for it, because that is what makes us human and makes us worthwhile.
Suzanne, she, her. Reverend Ralph's talk brought me back to my 1967 when I was a student at Northwestern in Chicago. And I made a friend with a young man who was African American. His name was Roger. He had a football scholarship to Northwestern. He was a lovely, gentle man, beautiful green eyes, I remember to this day. And for an entire winter, I think, I would go over to Roger's apartment a few blocks from campus in the afternoons, and we would listen to music. That was all we did. We may or may not have smoked something that wasn't tobacco. I can't really remember exactly. but all we did was listen to jazz. And Roger introduced me to John Coltrane and Miles Davis and Pharoah Sanders. And I just loved that music. It was all new to me. And I've always remembered him for that. And I wanted to, I was a sorority girl at that point, and I wanted to invite him to a sorority dance, which of course was all white girls, young white girls. Northwestern was known as the school parents' fathers wanted their daughters to go to because they'd be safe. And Roger fortunately had the good sense to realize that he'd probably lose his football scholarship. It would be a huge event on campus if he came to that dance with me. And he said, we can't do that. And so today I'm remembering Roger and hoping, I remember him as someone who is a friend, and I hope he might even remember me as the young white girl who wanted to do something for justice and believed that there was another way in the world.
I have retired from teaching speech at Madison College, but I always showed the I Have a Dream speech in its entirety to my students, mainly because people only heard the snippets of the like the content of my the content of character rather than color of skin. We also talked about his nonviolent passive resistance approach. I think often people I have been around felt he was ready to riot and burn and cause violence, and they completely missed a major thing of what he was about. They used to, before a march, get what was called all prayered up so they could go out and take a beating and not fight back. Take police dogs, take fire hoses, take whatever was about to happen. And that's been a real challenge for people to think about, my students or others, of am I actually able to win out by nonviolent resistance, passive resistance? I have a little bit more hope than Gary, but I really cannot refute his point of view, nor would I want to. He used to have his point of view. But anyhow, I think it's very challenging for people to think about how to have that approach instead of, gee, I ought to hit back. Somebody hit me, I ought to hit back. So there, a lot of times there are options.
I'm Mary Mellon. She, her, back in 1961, I was an exchange student at Spelman College. Those of you who've been here a long time have heard me talk about that. And it was a time of sit-ins, and at my college, or Spelman College, I was a student at North Central College, which is near Chicago. It's in Naperville, Illinois. And this was the first year of this exchange program of having white students go down and spend a semester at Spelman. And I did participate in one of those sit-ins, which was very, very safe because it was not where we sat in a restaurant and had people pour things over us, you know, like ketchup and mustard and all that kind of stuff. The plan was to take a white student and one of us and a black student and go to Rich's department store and go up to the cafeteria, which I think was a, you know, an upper floor, and to just go to the lunch counter and ask if we could be served. And we knew we were going to be told no. So our plan was to just turn away. You know, we had established they wouldn't serve us. And then to go to the dining room. Well, the dining room was one of those dining rooms where you have the velvet rope, you know, that when it's closed, the rope is there. And when it's open, the rope is just hanging there. And there was a white man standing there. And as we approached, he just took that velvet rope and put it right over the door and said, "We won't. You can't come in." So then our plan was just to go to leave. We had established we couldn't be served. So that was really nothing compared to what other people who really demonstrated did. But the other thing I wanted to say is that every year I've gone to the celebration of the Martin Luther King Day observance here in Madison. I would urge every one of you to go to, because it's a very uplifting thing. You know, people talk about how, you know, we can't, I mean, you've heard people here talk about how we can't ever really overcome all this prejudice and all the hate that's in the world. But you can feel uplifted by going to this. First of all, there's the Martin Luther King Day choir, community choir, and I think some people in here are participating in that. And it's a wonderful thing just to hear it. And then there are awards given, and there's always a keynote speech. Oh, and there's singing of like congregational singing. Well, I sing the song we're going to sing in a few minutes, Lift Every Voice and Sing. And it's just great to be in a group of hundreds of people singing that song and enjoying it, you know, like our choir sang today. It's really a good time. So if you want to be uplifted tomorrow at 5 p.m., just go on down to the Overture Center, and you'll have a good time.
Thank you. Are there any online? No. Okay. We share our offering this quarter with the Catalyst Project, a mutually supportive community for single mothers and their children who have experienced homelessness. Our offertory music is Galician Waltz from Galicia, the Celtic area of Spain, performed by Ann Sawyer and Suzanne Oliver. That was lovely, lovely. Thank you. Our closing words are found in our hymnal, number 584. It's a responsive reading titled A Network of Mutuality, and it was written by Martin Luther King Jr. I'll read the bold words, and you respond with the italic wording. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny.
Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
There are some things in our social system to which all of us ought to be maladjusted. We must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation.
The foundation of such a method is love.
Before it is too late, we must narrow the gaping chasm between our proclamations of peace and our lowly deeds which precipitate and perpetuate war. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means.
We shall hew out of the mountain of despair, stone of hope.
Our closing music is number 149, Lift Every Voice and Sing, accompanied by trumpets and verst. Please stand in heart and spirit.
Thank you.
Today, after the service, there is an interweave meeting in the annex for LGBTQ plus folks and friends. Prairie Evening Potluck is Thursday, January 23rd, 6 to 8 p.m. here in the meeting house. There will be a book discussion on Saturday, January 25th, 2 p.m. in the annex. Next Sunday service is Who We Are, Just Bakery by Greg Juarez. Baked goods will be sold, cash, check, and credit cards, all accepted. Any other last-minute announcements? Yeah.
A couple of things. Interweave is going to be pretty short today, so probably 11:30 to noon. So if you want a short meeting, you can stop on by. Also, we have cake to celebrate Rev Ralph. That will be served. Yay! I didn't have him take a picture with said cake because the bakery got it wrong, although maybe it would have been funny, but they said, farewell, Rev Walsh. So a couple letters in there were close. So there's cake. There's also somebody here, thank you, brought gluten-free, it says gluten-friendly, strawberry mini cupcakes, too, that are also plated. So, and there's a lot of those as well. Normally, I'd say let the people that need them have them, but I mean, there's enough, I think, for everybody to have one if you want one. So you can have cake and a cupcake as well. We have plenty of cake. And thank you so much to Rev Ralph. We are almost at our time. So I know during Joys and Concerns, a lot of us could thank Rev Ralph. But if we cannot do it during Joys and Concerns, the RE people would greatly appreciate it. And you can come up after the service and individually thank Rev Ralph.
It's now time for us to formally mark the conclusion of Rev. Ralph's service as our minister and to honor the bond that we have shared. In our free churches, the relationship between a minister and the congregation is sacred. It is formed through mutual trust and respect, as a minister's authority comes from the hearts and minds of those who are served. So, Rev. Ralph will each light a candle. I will begin. So, Rev. Ralph, as we come... As we come to this moment of closure, I invite you to share any parting words you have as our minister.
It has been just a honor and great privilege to be serving this congregation for the past 18 months, and I look forward to continuing being part of this wonderful community as a member. So I'm not going away, just coming back with a little different hat on.
We thank you for the wisdom you have shared from our pulpit. We thank you for the leadership you have offered. We thank you for the pastoral care you have provided us. And we accept with gratitude the gifts of your vision and knowledge. And now, with appreciation, we release you from your service as our minister.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Please. Oh. Want me to add that final segment.
So I let... This candle, one of them, now symbolizes Rev. Ralph's return to being a cherished member of Prairie. And the other candle represents Prairie's continuing ministry, carried forward by all of us together.
And I release you from the covenant we shared. May you go forward in peace, truth, and love.
And we release you from the covenant we have shared. May you go forward in peace, truth, and love. And we have a couple of gifts for you. Okay. The first one is a binder. In the beginning of the binder, there are notes of appreciation from many members. And there are a great many photos provided by Mary Mullen. And there's some information on the presentations you've shared with us over your time as being a minister. And in addition, there is a gift certificate to the Harvey House restaurant for you and Carlene.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
This concludes our service.